My name is Gords, also known as MC WizKid. Welcome to Series 1 of the Pod Noodle. Ladies and gentlemen, once again here on the Pod Noodle, we have got basically royalty of the dance music scene. One of the finest DJs to ever touch a set of turntables, and I do not say this lightly. And equally, some of you guys will have known that often at the start of our sets together I mention this, but it really is the truth. The guy I'm about to chat with is literally the first hardcore DJ I ever listened to when I was just a kid on cassette from a set from Dreamscape 2. He went on to be a friend, and we've worked together for many, many years, and he's honestly one of the most inspiring humans in our music genre. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give to you the legend that is DJ Dougal. Dougal, welcome. How are you?
Very good. Thank you very much. That's a lovely intro.
Well, it is nothing but the truth, and I can't...
You made me blush.
I can't thank you enough for joining us today. I mean, literally, you really are an inspiration, and I can't wait to find out more. I mean, obviously, I know you on a friendship level for many years, but some of these questions, I'm literally probably going to turn into a raver while I'm talking to you today, because... honestly, you were a massive part of my journey into the music and still are today. So, okay, well, let's get started. Let's not mess about, because I know that people are going to be super keen to hear what you have to say. So if I rewind it all the way back to the very, very beginning, and obviously we know that your dad's sort of involved and he's a cameraman and all this kind of stuff, but I want to talk about you just for a hot second here. How did you kind of get into the music? Do you remember those sort of early raver days? Obviously, you were a kid yourself, but I'm not going to tell your story. I'd like you to do a little bit of that. Can you tell us about the very beginning?
So, right, if I go back literally to the dot where it all started for me, was I used to listen to Radio Northampton, and they would have I must have been 12 years old, maybe even 11. And they would go to a nightclub called Zazoo's in Milton Keynes, and they would broadcast this club live. And that was sort of even though, you know, you look at Radio sort of Northampton as like a commercial station, they would have this night, and they were playing really good, the beginnings of like sort of house music. And I was listening to this house music, and that sort of where the dance element got into my blood. And I was just fascinated by hearing mixing for like the first time. And if I go back even slightly earlier than that, 1985, when I was 10 years old, I remember watching Salt and Pepper, and they were live on stage at Live Aid. And I think that was probably the first time I've seen a set of 1210s where I saw people mixing and scratching. So that's where the sort of the inklings of like DJing, mixing came from. The rave scene, it didn't even exist in my mind then, so that was coming later, but that was the absolute seeds of it, the very, very dot.
I absolutely love that. I mean, Spinderella, I think her name was, wasn't it, the DJ from Salt and Pepper, and I remember sort of being mystified by her when I was a youngster, the same as you. I mean, they really sort of brought something to, along with the others, of course, there's many others that we could, of course, mention, but because they were so big when we were sort of 9, 10 years old, you're right to say that. I'm not surprised that sort of fascinated you. I mean, how did that transition from sort of watching, you know, artists like Salt and Pepper sort of then find its way into your life and your circle and, you know, your bedroom or wherever you had your deck set up?
Right. So here's the long old story of it. Again, it's amazing when I actually open my mind to think, God, where, because I don't sit there and really think about this. So actually sort of delve in is so interesting for myself. Yeah. So when you think about tracks like Salt and Pepper, Push It, they had these catchy little riffs. And you know, the sort of Salt and Pepper riff, everyone knows the Push It riff. Not that I'm going to sing Wizzer.
No, that's all good. We all know it. You don't need to. It's all good.
So these catchy little riffs, and then there was a track called Nitro Deluxe, Let's Get Brutal, and that had like this catchy little riff again that was just used to just stick in my head. So as I'm sort of growing up, I'm starting to hear these tunes with these little catchy riffs, very, very simple. So this is all going into me, influencing me. And at that time, I was mainly a crazy skateboarder. And I basically at school, for the CDT, it was craft design technology lessons. My mind was everywhere. I couldn't concentrate, and the teacher allowed me to build a skateboard ramp at school. So me and my friends would go around nicking all the wood from all these building sites. I'm going to get myself in trouble here, aren't I, Wizard?
It's all good.
All this wood from these building sites. We used to take it to the school, and I basically started in the lunch breaks mainly building this half-pipe skateboard ramp, all the bits for it. And one lunchtime, I said to all the guys, right, we've got everything we need here. And, you know, we'd built a substantial mini ramp in bits. Not really rectified it properly, just sort of worked it out that it was okay. Got everybody, I think it was like 20, 30 kids, to basically walk all these skateboard ramp parts to my mum and dad's house. So come all the way down, all the way to Stanley's Barn from Western Pavel Shopping Centre. And we put this ramp up. And, I mean, it was a big ramp. It had 8 foot high. It had an 8 foot transition on it. If people who know about skateboarding, coping, about 8 foot flat. Not that my mum and dad had a big garden, but we basically took over with this skateboard ramp. And it was such a success. It was unbelievable. All the kids, like when we're all bored, would all be coming to my garden. And it was just the best summers ever. But guess what happened? Council come along and said it was an illegal ramp and it needed building permission and God knows what.
What?
The council, yeah, they made me take the skateboard ramp down, and it was absolutely devastating for me. So, like, all my friends then, we all had to take this ramp down. But I had all this wood, and I'm thinking, what the fuck am I going to do with this wood? And that's at the same time, my dad was sort of retiring from DJing, and he only did like sort of weddings and stuff. He wasn't like obviously dance DJ. And he had like old belt drive decks, and then I've been watching these Salt and Pepper videos, and I'm thinking, I know I'm gonna build a stage in my bedroom. So with all the wood and everything from the skateboard ramp, I basically took it upstairs in my bedroom, painted my bedroom gloss black paint.
Wow.
And rectified this stage, and I've still got pictures of it. And then I got all sort of my dad's disco lights and basically made a club, I suppose, 14 years old in my bedroom.
Amazing.
So that was like, that was stage one to everything.
That's phenomenal.
So you want me to carry on?
Please. I'm hanging off you every word here. I'm literally imagining it. So stage one, you've painted your room black. You've built a stage in your bedroom. I actually think that there was a tune in the early 90s that had a little young one sample that said a disco in my bedroom or something like that. You literally had it. That was every kid's dream, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So then I started doing paper rounds, and straight away from the beginning, I had my dad's support. So he had a few disco speakers, but then we'd sort of like, I'd try and get some money from doing paper rounds, and it wasn't a lot. But me and my dad, we went to an auction and we started buying more speakers, and there was a nightclub that went bankrupt, and they had this Dynacord sound system that they were selling at the auction, and nobody was interested in it. These speakers were so big, they were ridiculous. And my dad managed to get them for me. We might have paid like, I don't know, £50-75 or something for these speakers. But for, you know, today's money, worth, you know, a couple of £1,000.
Yeah.
So I had all of a sudden this incredible sound system. Then I just kept doing paper rounds, getting a bit more money. And then was the next big turning point. I did, it was time for my work experience. So we went to, I was supposed to be doing a clothes shop called Insanity, where one of the very first DJs that was playing for ESP used to play in the daytime. So it'd be a clothes shop, there'd be a DJ there, it was sort of like a hairdresser's there. It was like this real cool hangout place. So yeah, I must have been 14 at that point, supposed to be doing my work experience there. And the day I went in, the place burnt to the ground.
Right? Oh, wow.
So that work experience was over.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it was really strange because that was going to lead me on a path to be with all these people with, say, ESP, who found as a dreamscape. But that just stopped there and then. So my dad got on the phone to a guy called Martin, and he owned a disco shop on the Wellingborough Road in Northampton. And I think at that time it was called MSM, and then it changed its name later to Fabtronic. So he agreed to allow me to do my work experience there. So I go in, first day, I'm like saying, right, Paul, you're like, and I'm skinny as anything. They're like, you need to move these speakers from here to there and do this, do that. And they started teaching me how to wire up all these lighting plugs and everything. And it was just sort of slowly bringing me into it. And I started getting on with everyone. And they said, oh, on Friday night, we're setting up speakers, the PA system, for this really like, sort of, it's almost like an illegal rave in a place called Castaways in Bedford. Now, Castaways is then what went on to be called Milwaukee's.
Yeah.
Oh, so I was like, oh, my God, I need to go to this Castaways. And just the word Castaways is in the middle of nowhere. So back home that day, Mum, Dad, I need to go to Castaways and set up the speakers. I've been told I'm going to be looked after. They knew the guy who run the shop. And they said, okay, you know, if they're going to look after you, you can go. So Mum and Dad dropped me off at the disco shop, 9 o'clock, I think it was, on Friday night. And they said, right, come on in. We're going to get all the cables, all these speakers. And I had this huge PV rig. It was absolutely ridiculous. Especially in that day and age. The next thing, again, I'm carrying these speakers that are like 10 foot tall, no joke. Like me and this huge black guy built like God knows what, and I'm trying to hold one end of the speaker. Anyway, loading up all the vans, we get to this Castaway, say, in the middle of nowhere, and I'll never forget. And then we took these speakers in, we set them up. I'm learning how to do everything. I'm laying all the cables, running them around the room. It was a strobe machine, PV sound system, two 1210s, and a fog machine. And that was it. And then I think it was like 10:30 sharp, boom, on it come.
Wow.
I'd never heard bass like it. And the songs, when it was tunes, it was around that LFO time, maybe even a little bit pre-LFO.
Yeah.
And the sub bass, it was the first time I most probably really experienced sub bass and all these bleeps and blob sounds. And it was that moment that changed my life forever. It was like, I'm done. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, totally. Do you know, you've triggered a memory with me. I remember still being at school, and there was a club in Peterborough. I think you were very much on the scene by this point, because obviously I got into it slightly later than you did. And I remember going to this club called Shock in Peterborough. And I wasn't old enough to be there, first of all. And I'd gone with the older lads who were causing a nuisance, because that's what they sort of did in those days. And I remember Mickey Finn's Some Justice. And you know, in the middle of the record, the sub kind of goes, woo, doesn't it? And I remember that tingly feeling that you got from the bass, that sort of, it made the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, doesn't it?
Oh, it was absolutely incredible. I mean, the music, it didn't exist anywhere. Nobody had heard anything like it. It was so futuristic. If you think about all the music before, even like the house music, they weren't sort of playing with like, I mean, it was just an oscillator, basically, a sine wave that creates these subtones. And nobody before that point ever experimented with messing around with sine tones to create the sort of sub bass. So
yeah,
I remember LFO, they said they used one finger at sort of one octave on the keyboard, and then they'd have the next hand down on the lower octave. So you can hear the bass and you could feel it as well. And this is like the techniques they were using.
Amazing.
So then it was, that was that with that sort of start, and then get back to school after my work experience, and I'm running around the school going, everyone, have you heard of rave music? And like, rave, what you want about rave? And I'm like, listen to this. And they all just thought I was mad, but I had a really good bunch of friends through the skateboarding. So I was then like, right, this is next. Let's put a rave on at the school. And they're again, all thinking I'm mad. I'm like, you know, 15 years old. I'm like, come on, we can do this.
Yeah.
And I started showing everybody all the flyers and everything. And a couple of my friends were really good at sort of design and stuff and drawing. There's a guy called Wayne. And I said, can you do banners? Like, if we get big lumps of material, can you sort of do ideas like this? So we did one rave sort of poster and stuff and knocked it all up. And I went to the school and said, look, can I hire the school college block to put a disco on, I called it to them. And they were like, yeah. I said, look, my mum and dad, you know, they'll be a part of it. And they just looked at it as just a tiny little thing. So then what I did is went to the place where I did the work experience and said, how much would you charge me to use exactly the same system that you were putting in Milwaukee's or Castaways at that time? Would you charge me to put in my school? And they're like, oh, God, well, bloody hell, we'll do it. You know, we'll whatever you want to give us, you know, we'll do it for a drink. You know, we'd love to help you. So I knocked up all the flyers, all the posters, £2.50 a ticket, and I just went round all of the school selling tickets. I went to all the sort of the what they call them at that time, nappy nights, you know, under 18 nights, with like sort of all the music on like my headphones, what we were going to play, all the posters and flyers. And next thing you know, I've sold 500 tickets.
Oh, wow.
Old. I mean, yeah, that's still an achievement.
Isn't it just? You'd be happy if you did that today.
So on my flyer, I said that I was going to have a 10,000 watt sound system. And I did like sort of all these, you know, the big claims, 10,000 watts. And everyone was like, my dad says you're not going to have more than, 200 watts. You know, you're lying. There's no way you're having 10,000 watts. And I was like, we'll see.
Yeah.
And I remember I think the party was going to start at 8 o'clock, and all the kids, they actually got down there most probably before at 7 o'clock to sort of actually watch the setup. And then we turn up with these speakers, and I think they're expecting a couple of speakers, you know, maybe, you know, a couple of foot high, a couple of foot wide. And, you know, we had there, they were like coffins, these huge PV rig. And we just took them in. And when they did the bass check, they used to go through the bass first, turn on the subs, turn on the mids, turn on the tops, and they'd go through, put on the subs, and I swear the lighting in this school college block rattled and started falling down. The windows sounded like they were going to blow out. Everyone's
wow.
face was like, what the hell? And again, everyone come in. It was fog machines, strobes, the sound system, and it was incredible. And the next day, me and my family got banned for life from ever hiring college block again. Me and my mum and dad got banned.
Wow.
So that was, I mean, that's the real fundamentals of the beginning of my journey.
Do you know what's wonderful is your dad has always been, and your mum, of course, I'm not leaving her out, but that so supportive of everything you do. Don't you think that you're in an extremely fortunate position to have that, you know, growing up and throughout your life? I mean, it's wonderful the influence that he had on your journey, but also the way that he supported you through these crazy sort of things that you got into, like skateboarding and running a rave and speakers and DJing and all of the, it's incredible to listen to. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, they were there for me from day one, and I think they knew I struggled with all other aspects of school. I didn't even realize it until recently. You know, I was I'm dyslexic as bad as you can be. I just cannot write, and my handwriting is so terrible nobody could ever read it. And then later on you find out the reason why my handwriting's so that bad is because my ADHD was so bad. I'm like writing at 2,000 mile an hour and now I can read it. So I think they realized I was never gonna be an academic, so they realized I was on the creative spectrum, and they followed it. And the same for my mum and dad. My dad's dyslexic as well, and so you realize that, you know, and his attention span's quite short. And he's a creative. He loves, you know, he loves music, he loves art, you know, he's into his photography. So I think they realize that's where, you know, that's where my path was going to be. So they supported it.
It's wonderful. It really is. So thinking about the learning to DJ bit, then that was going to be sort of my next question. But I mean, I guess with your dad, kind of, I know he was a different type of DJ, but being in and around that stuff, I suppose it's a bit like, I've, as you know, I've got three children, and all of them kind of know that loosely how to DJ because I'm their dad and I show them and they're always around music and obviously I'm obsessed with it, etc. So I suppose that probably mirrored its way into your life, I guess, from your dad.
Yeah, so what my dad taught me, mixing was not a thing my dad even knew anything about at all. It was just one record to finish, and as it sort of came to the end, you just fade the next one up. But what my dad absolutely taught me to do was how to read a dance floor, because he would tell me that when he was doing weddings, the worst thing for him, you'd get everyone up dancing and then one wrong song and you'd clear the floor. And all I ever remember him going saying, oh God, if you play the wrong song and it clears the dance floor. I mean, you imagine, you know, you're playing and literally you clear the dance floor. And that's what sort of these sort of DJs used to have happen, you know, or some people not feeling it. And I started doing weddings once I started to build up some kit. So all of my learning was from doing basically weddings and doing really long sets of like 6 to 7 hours. And what happened was, because I had the kit, all of a sudden I was buying all the sort of the rave music. And then if there was 18-year-olds having a party and they wanted a sort of a DJ that actually knew about the rave scene and the cool stuff, there was no other DJs doing that sort of stuff at all. It's like everyone else was like, you know, Barry Doubledex, you know, it was like sort of proper ritzy style DJ.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden I started getting booked for these events, but for these gigs, these actual, well, maybe birthday parties of cool kids, even weddings of cool kids. And I would be playing all the tunes like, you know, Move Your Body from Expansions.
Yeah,
and, you know, I was trying to think at that time, Rizella, Everybody's Free.
Was Felix, Don't You Want Me, all of those kind of stuff.
Yeah, 808 State, Cubic, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And that was sort of like my learning of you know, of how to keep people on the dance floor. You sort of keeping people there for 5-6 hours, trying to keep giving a really good time.
It's phenomenal. How did the transition go? Because obviously by this point you've, I suppose, conquered your nerves. Well, I'm going to say conquered your nerves, but if you're kind of going on skating, then you've got to be kind, you've got to have that sort of, I had a go at skateboarding. I injured myself quite badly. I think we've spoke about this in the past, but I injured my left arm, so I can't straighten my arm for the rest of my life. So I was never, I'll show you next time we're together. But I was never very good at it. But some of my mates, they were kind of wily and they were really into it. And I just so wanted to be like them and as good as them, but I just wasn't. Now, based on you having a half pipe and doing all these things, obviously you've kind of got that 2-foot mentality already. So I assume the transition into performing in front of people, you've already kind of got that bravery, I suppose, that the skateboarders that kind of engage in that kind of stuff from an early age have. But how did the transition sort of from doing the cool kids' birthday parties and the weddings and everything, how did that sort of morph into what I suppose is the beginnings of your career and Dreamscape and all that kind of stuff that happened in the early 90s?
So I was booked for an event at a place called Crazy Coyote in Northampton, and it was a basement. And I think it started at 11 at night and we went through till 6 in the morning, and all they wanted was all the rave music and that was it. And one of my friends, he was a bit older than me, and this is Gary, and I'm sure you remember Gary.
Long of course, Gary, yeah, man. Gary is a ledge. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, so Gary, his girlfriend knew Murray from Dreamscape. Well, it wasn't Dreamscape then, Murray from ESP, and another guy called Craig, and they were the sort of the partners in ESP. And it just so happened they got invited down to this party, what I was playing at, and they were like behind me all the way saying, you've got to come and listen to Paul play. He's like, you know, might only be sort of 15, 16 years old, but you've got to come and have a listen. And I remember Murray walked in front of me, and I had this old piece of vinyl. It was Simon Harris, and it was called Beats, Breaks and Scratches.
Yeah, man, I believe, yeah.
Oh, it's got them sort of the sounds you used to use for scratching, the break and the bass and all that mad stuff. Yeah. And then I just started sort of scratching in front of him, and he was like, you've got to come to my club on Friday, and you've got to do that. So they'd sort of seen me setting up the speakers, because I was still setting up the speakers at every Castaways event, Milwaukee's. Yeah. And then they saw me scratching, and nobody else had done anything like that. So they were looking at me thinking, who is this kid? He's got all this stuff. He's got all this music. He might only like, you know, be 15 years old, but sod it. Let's give him a go. So Murray said to me, right, you can start warming up at Milwaukee's Castaways. And I did. I used to start playing the first hour. I'd start doing that set. And don't get me wrong, I was bloody nervous.
of course.
But I loved it so much. I just, you know, had to do it. So just started doing more of them every week. And then I'll never forget, Murray comes to me one day and he goes, Paul, I've got a warehouse in Milton Keynes. It's completely empty. I'm going to put a rave on there. I'm going to go from doing, and that's probably whatever it was, Milwaukee's, Castaways, maybe 400 or 500. And he said, we're going to do something for 3,000 people. And you're going to be the first DJ on. And I was like, what?
That's mental. And yeah, and like I mean, it's hard to fathom for me because, as I say, your then sets, as they still do today, kind of like inspired me so much. And I think I've listened to your Dreamscape 2 set. I still listen to it today, Paul. I still play that set in my car when I'm driving around. And it's almost like my go-to old school set, all the, you know, 20, 30 years later. It's mental. But to sort of think that you've kind of gone from weddings and parties to warming up in Milwaukee's and whatever. And I'm also mindful, actually, while I'm sort of summarizing, like, you were just a kid. It must have been quite scary for you, all these adults, especially, you know, hot off the back of Acid House. There's a lot of drugs around and ecstasy and all that kind of stuff. It must have been quite a daunting experience for a kid to be in that environment.
Well, it absolutely was. And I never took drugs at all. I wasn't even a drinker. I was 16 years old. I wasn't like anything. And it's weird because I had sort of, at that time when I was going into the raves, I was seeing people, I mean, really chewing their face off. I was like, I'm not doing that. Absolutely not. And this, again, is all part of the journey, what leads me to my style in music. So, yeah, that was daunting. The people I was up against sort of DJing, the people would be on after me, was unbelievably, like, Cole Cox would be on after me, Nicky Finn, Groove Rider, Fabio, LSD, Swanee. Wow. They're, you know, they're all like 25 years old, and this is like, I'm just looking at them going, oh my god,
yeah,
I want to
be absolutely
guys.
And I suppose you were fans of them as well, because like people like, you know, Mickey Finn and I mean, obviously Cole Cox went on to be the biggest DJ in the world, of course, but at this point he sort of early 90s, man, he's absolutely smashing it. So it must have been really, like, scary, I guess is the fair word to use.
Oh, absolutely. I remember holding the needle to put it down on my first track, and it was shaking. I could not hold the needle. It was, like, going to jump out of my hand, the nerves. Yeah. And mixing them was so difficult because the records were not, they're not perfectly in time. I didn't even realize that they're moving all the time. So if you're trying to like get the pitch right on a record and think that you can get it there and leave it, no way. You've got to be riding that pitch. And the records weren't really designed to DJ at that time either, especially because I liked records were started with a piano. And as I'm trying to mix a piano in and it, you're trying to, you know, move it, as you hear the you can hear the piano. So it was very, very difficult to mix. If you get the breaks and the beats, it was easier, but anything with pianos and, oh God, it was just so stressful, and trying to do that in front of all them people and all that noise, and the volume is incredible and the decks are jumping, and it was just madness.
Well, you did it with such a fine art. I mean, one of my favorite transitions on that early Dreamscape set that I keep banging on about is you had taken Far Out by Sons of Loop de Loop and mixed it with Blame, Music Takes You, and it was the Seal version with the little vocal in it. And that, for me, that little point of that set, I mean, wow. And now I think technology's moved on. You know, you can quickly at a glance see what key a record's, you know, made in on your record box. And, you know, obviously the tempo's digital now and it all locks together really nice. And you can even go into your stems and use acapellas if you want to, of songs that didn't have an acapella previously. But to be doing that so early on and as just a young boy in your career, I mean, clearly this was the pathway for you. Clearly. I mean, there's no mistake that you had a gift from early, man. So it's crazy for me to hear you talk about sort of nudging the record on and the piano being affected by that little nudge along. You did it with such style and such class. I mean, from early you were kind of rinsing these sets, but wow, you should look back on that era and be very proud of yourself, man, because it was an absolute game changer.
Oh, thank you. I mean, to be honest, sometimes I would get flack about my mixing because I was trying such, I suppose, complex mixes that I'd still struggle to do today. And if all of a sudden there's a delay on the rig, someone in the audience, they don't understand that there's like a half a second delay. You've got the MC screaming through it, and it's distorting, and you're trying to pull off these mixes. And then all of a sudden, you know, one of the dancers nudges the, you know, dances and the needle jumps and it goes out. It was so, so stressful. But I wanted to create the feeling of ecstasy without being on drugs is the truth of it. I would just wanted to make people like rush, and if they're on drugs as well, well, God, even higher feeling for them. So
amazing. I mean, thinking about all these sort of famous DJs around you, did you ever get starstruck? You know, like, did you ever sort of think, oh my God, there's, I don't know, Carl Cox, oh God, there's LSD, or, you know, like, was that ever a thought process for you, or did it just sort of feel natural?
I mean, absolutely, to start with, I think it was that big turning point where I actually saw my name on a flyer next to him. I mean, you know, I remember that I was going to the raves before I was on the Big Dreamscape flyer, just as a raver. And I'd see, say, like DJ Rap, and, you know, she was like, look at her and think, oh my God, incredible. Yeah. It's just these people. I mean, they're just, they're like superstars. And to then all of a sudden to be on the stage with them, well, it's just amazing.
do you know, I remember because I don't know whether you know this or not, I'm sure you probably do, but before I became an MC, I was a DJ, right? So my first gigs out and about were DJ gigs. And I started playing at Hyperbolic and various parties. Anyway, I got booked to do a little party over in Didcot near Oxford. And I'd not long passed my driving test, so I suppose I was 17. And I drove over there and I played the set. And while we were chilling, Murray Dreamscape turned up and he was with Clarkey and a couple of other guys. And I remember looking across the room going, oh my God, there's Murray Dreamscape. And of course, my only experience of Clarkey had been his live sets, but nonetheless, everyone goes, there's DJ Clarkey. And I'm like, wow, it's Clarkey from Dreamscape. And anyway, fast forward a little bit to my first MC gig, and I was booked for an early set to see how I got on. And if I got on well, then I would go on to do more. But if I didn't, that would be the end of that. And I was on with Clarkey. And of course, he was playing sort of the harder techno-y stuff. And I remember thinking in my head, oh my God, I'm MCing for Clarkey. Like, I can't believe that I am MCing. Like me, no one's going to believe this at home. I'm MCing for Clarkey right now. And obviously it went well and the rest is history, blah, blah, blah. But I just remember that feeling of fear, excitement. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience. Was that kind of a similar feeling for you, you know, like DJing and then Groove Riders going? Did you ever sort of think, oh, my God, I can't believe that I'm on before Groove Rider? Like, was that ever a thing for you?
Oh, I mean, absolutely, 100,000,000%. And the maddest bit for me, I think, was when I got Slipmat's phone number. It's like, wow. And then you start getting these people, you know, the guy's number, and all of a sudden, you know, they're sort of, my God, I've got Slipmat's number, I've got Carl Cox's number, I've got Stuart Allen's number, you know, and all these people I'm starting to become friends with, and they wanted to help me. I mean, Slipmat really helped me.
Yeah.
He started helping me get gigs in Skegness, the Pleasure Dome Fantasy Island. And a big, big thanks to Slipmat for what he did for me.
Well, actually, you're not the first person actually to name check Slipmat, because, I don't want to reveal too much for the other episodes that I'm going to share as we go, but lots of people pay homage to Slipmat, including one of the previous episodes. Hixie goes on to say what a big deal it was linking with Slipmat and getting to know him. So I've no surprise that you say that, but also I think, slip mat has been part of our lives and our culture for so long now that you almost forget how important he is. You know, like the influence he had. I mean, recently on my TikTok, I share classic records every day. And obviously, like you, I have a relationship with Slipmat where he's a friend and we've got, you know, we've worked together for many years. So I dropped him a message and said, look, I'm going to be doing Ragga Tip. Will you do me a video that I can sort of sneak into the background somewhere in the video? He's like, yeah, man, no worries. Leave it with me. And then the next day he'd sent me a silly little clip because I told him to do it. He's so supportive of artists, the genre, the art form. And yeah, man, big up Slipmat. So yeah, shout out to Slipmat, man. What a legend.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. God, yeah. He was an absolute hero without a doubt.
Totally. Totally. And like yourself, and actually, he was a master of the art as well, man. Many of his sets sort of, they almost harmonically blended like yours did in those early times, you know, without the technology. That's the important thing that I want to say to people listening to this is when you dip in on a real early 90s set by Dougal or by Slipmat, or even some of the others from other genres like Mickey Finn or Darren J, they were harmonically mixing from their ear. There was no technology involved. There was no cheats. There was no software. You weren't Googling what key a song is. They were doing it naturally. And for me, that's a beautiful thing. And certainly for hardcore, you, Slipmat, and perhaps Swanee were total masters of that art in those early days, man. So big ups, man.
Thank you very much. So yeah, didn't even realize what we were doing.
Yeah, it's crazy. It sounds crazy. Well, maybe it just feels natural. Well, listen, I'm talking about you being one of the best DJs on earth, and literally you go on to become one of the first number one DJs. So talk to me about that. Like, how did that feel? How did what happened, man?
So as I started doing all the getting booked for the Dreamscape parties and all of the ESP Milwaukee's events, what would happen is a lot of the DJs, they start getting so busy they couldn't turn up. So all of a sudden I would be there. So someone doesn't turn up, Paul, jump on. So all of a sudden I started getting these little sort of half hour slots through the night. And as I was doing that, then I think Murray saw that, bloody hell, he's actually, you know, maybe done better than the guy who was supposed to be turning up. And it's like, well, you know, he's going, Jesus, Paul, this is great. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah. So that sort of started happening. And then there was a turning point in my career, without a doubt. I was just the warm-up guy and the filling guy. And that was all I was at that point. And I think that must have been 1993. But then New Year's Eve, it was at Dreamscape, Milton Keynes, LTJ Bookham went on 12 till 1 and he played like this really heavy sort of dreamy set. And it was a beautiful thing. I mean, it was a masterpiece in that style of music, but it definitely wasn't a party set. So far from it. It was very spacey. So he finishes his set, then I come on straight on with Awesome Free, Please Don't Go, Far Out, Prodigy, Your Love. And I've still to this day, I've never experienced everything like it. Everybody was there. Everyone's on the people's shoulders. People looked like they were crying. It was like, I was like, what is happening? And it was that moment there that changed my life forever. I was actually at college. I was doing a bit of college then, BTEC Media College, if you believe. And I used to take a diary with me, and I think I had one of the very first sort of mobile phones. And from praying the thing that would ring, from that moment onward, I swear to you, I was getting 5 calls a day. Wow. It was madness. And my diary went from 0 to 5 bookings every Friday and Saturday, and that just went on for years solid. And that's when I couldn't even drive yet, and my dad used to have to drive me to the gigs. So my dad would come along, and guess what? He's got his camera. He'd start taking all the pictures, doing all the filming. He was allowed because they knew he was my dad. He made friends with everyone. Well, they didn't want any outside photographers in because they didn't know if they were going to sell pictures to the press or anything. So next thing you know, my dad's driving me all over the country, and it was just insane.
I love that. Do you know what? Like, the mad thing is, like, as you've just said that, my brain took me off to present day. And there's so much pretense in today's DJ world, isn't there? Like, not so much in our genre, because we're one of the smaller genres in present day, aren't we? Of course, we're sort of at the bottom of the pile of that type of thing. But if you look at the sort of high-end EDM house and all that, like, nowadays, as opposed to the purity that you had when your dad was filming you and the reaction from the crowd, nowadays it's sort of all perception. So they'll sort of feed into their budget if you're booking said DJ. They'll sort of allow for their travel and their manager and all of these other things. But also there'll be part of their fee that goes on the guy or the girl that's going to film it all, right? And they're only going to share angles where it looks busy. They're only going to share angles of people having a good time. And they're only going to show the little pinnacle moments of the set in order and hope that this DJ goes on to look amazing. Everyone blows smoke and they get lots of other work. But you would kind of like, what you've just said is probably one of the earliest documents of what went on to be a horrible monster that it is today. But in your days, it was so pure and beautiful. Have you ever thought about that?
I do sit there. That is something I do think about. I just realised that it was such a magic moment that will never be able to be recreated again. The innocence of it all was just what made it so, so special. And there's other things that sort of lead on from that, that the music, if you wanted to hear the music, you had to go to a rave. It wasn't played on the radio. You didn't have a Spotify and Apple. The only place was go to the rave, or we're all sharing tape packs, and the tape packs were just flying around everywhere. And if someone had special tape from Amnesia, you'd be like, can I get it? And if you want to record it, oh my God, it was incredible.
It really was. It was a culture, man. Like, I remember I used to, later on around 95, I had my own record shop, which sadly failed miserably because I ended up keeping all the records and not selling them and making absolutely no money. But nonetheless, before those days, I worked for a period in a record shop called Vinyl To You in Peterborough. I helped out in another record shop called Exit Records, which was also in Peterborough. And I'd gather all the flyers, and then one of your brethren would go, oh, have you got the set from Amnesia House? Have you heard the Top Buzz set? And I'd go, nah. And he'd lend you the cassette and you'd go home and you'd record it. And then, I don't know if you were the same, but I'd get the flyer and I'd cut out a little cover for the cassette put little stickers on it or whatever, or I'd cut out the name of the DJ and put it on the sort of spine of the... And you're right, it was so pure and innocent and things... Rightly or wrongly, you know, business is business and things moved on. I talked about this a little bit recently about flyers, actually. In the old day, it was all about the artwork. You know, the Dreamscape flyers were iconic because of the designs on them. Same with Helter Skelter, Pez, Junior Tomlin, all of those amazing artists that are around there. Now, all of the marketing is based around the brand. It's all about brand awareness. You've got to have the brand right in the middle and it's got to be really obvious. And I suppose things do evolve and they move on. But it's the reason I think I'm so emotionally attached to the early 90s is because listening to you, who's at the heart of this stuff, share these stories, it was so pure and beautiful, man. It really did sort of start off with such innocence, didn't it?
It's incredible. And sort of, you're just bringing up sort of more memories that I completely forgot about. Jen, just as the DJing started, and I'm definitely not a businessman because I do everything through passion, but my passion then led me to, I want to make music. I want to make records. So that's coming from the DJing. Yeah. And I've got to do this, and I want to start a record label. And it's like, all of a sudden, I remember I had this terrible car. It's this knackered old, this is once, passed my driving test. Yeah. This terrible Fiesta. And every time I took my foot off the accelerator, the car would cut out. But I drove down to London. I'd get with my dad from a song that I'd made with, it was Mickey Skidow at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, let's get this record pressed. And you go to the cutting house and you give them the dat and they do the master for you. And then I'd get that master and I'd have to take that somewhere else to where they actually press the records. Then a week later, I'd have to go back down in this crappy old Fiesta that couldn't even get up a hill. And I'd stack the back of the car up with boxes, get 1,000 of these records pressed up. And then you take them to the distributor.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, my God, I'm 17 years old when I look back and we're getting records distributed, getting labels designed, getting them pressed, putting them out. And it was, I just don't even know where we got this drive from and how we did it. I think I'd struggle now. Well, but this car I always remember used to break down with the records in the back, and I'd be like, God's sake.
Well, you had to do everything manually. I mean, but I mean, and obviously you've mentioned you've played that iconic New Year's Eve set. Your phones rang off the hook. You're now number one DJ in the land, and all of your heroes. Listen, the way that I, as someone who's been a number one in my genre several times, as you know, it's a nice accolade and it feels good. But actually, people like what they like, right? So it doesn't necessarily take anything away from the other DJs that weren't number one DJ. They're all just equally as amazing, doing their equally as awesome job. But if we're talking about the title and that accolade, then at that point in time, you were essentially the number one DJ, man. I mean, at such a young age, I mean, it's comparable to, I suppose, Martin Garrix and the level of hit success he had commercially. I mean, how did that feel being the sort of the Milky Bar kid, you know, like the boy wonder? I mean, was it strange? Did it feel normal? Did anything change?
Well, it was just... Sorry, I forgot to go back to this point. So I remember I was in Murray's office in Findon, and it was where he did all the T-shirts and everything for the Dreamscape merchandise. He said, Paul, you know, you're at the top on the MTV and the Turnitin Awards voting so far. Apparently you're ahead, and it's looking like you're going to get it. And I was like, you what? And I'm like, that's against Carl Cox. It's against everybody. Yeah, DJ Rap, Mickey Finn, Groove Rider, Fabio. I mean, it wasn't separated at that time. It was all of them.
It was all
DJs,
in, wasn't it? Yeah, there was no sub. Yeah,
it was all in. And then there's my name in there, and I think people had to even like write a little slip or something from the back of Eternity magazine and send it in or do something.
Yeah,
with
it was all posted, and they used to have it on the tickets as well. You could write your votes on the tickets and then post the tickets in. So you had to get a stamp, put it in. There was effort involved. It wasn't just
there
an
was
online.
Effort.
There wasn't just an online poll. Like, people had to go out of their way to do this stuff, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is, the guy from Eternity, they didn't perfectly get on with Murray, so there was definitely no favoritism, if you know what I mean, towards Dreamscape or that, because there was definitely a little bit of friction. And next thing, Murray turns around to me and he says, Paul, he goes, you're not going to believe it, Dreamscape's won best event, and you've won best DJ. And yeah, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. It was just, I suppose, I still won't believe it to this day, really. It was incredible.
Unbelievable, man, and such an amazing, inspiring story. Thank you for sharing that. Listen, you mentioned Mickey Skeedle. I don't want to go too deep on this particular episode. I'd like to get you back and talk about, because I feel like the Happy Hardcore era is probably a podcast on its own. I feel like we could probably talk about that era for an hour if we really wanted to. So I want to kind of like take the stone and skim the top of the water with Happy Hardcore. As people have said, I said this with Hixie, like, there's no secret that the negative stuff is out there. There's good and there's bad, there's yin and there's yang. And if you've tuned into this podcast to sort of hear the negative stories, or where did it all go wrong, and, you know, and all of that kind of nonsense that I care not about, then sadly, this is not the podcast for you. But what I do want to talk to you is that I've got one of the pinnacle artists from Happy Hardcore, much the same as Hixie, much the same as Slipmat and Seduction and all those other guys that were really the poster boys of this genre. I mean, how did it feel? Obviously, the tempo's etched up, the kick drum started to come in, you've still got the breaks and the rolling Amons and all that kind of stuff. But once again, you're situated right at the heart, right at the middle of this happy hardcore explosion. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
So what happened was, is as a raver, I was going to places like... the eclipse, even though with that DJing that was going on, I still want to get out there and enjoy myself. And the music went ever so dark. It went so, it was just break beats and bass lines. And this was it. And you'd look at the atmosphere. I remember standing there in Milwaukee's looking at the atmosphere and going, what the hell is going on? It's so miserable. And because I didn't do drugs, and funny enough, Hixie didn't do drugs, Slipknot didn't do drugs, Vibes didn't do drugs, we're all like starting to lose the will to live with this music. It was just so, so moody. So at that point, we were like, well, yeah, this moody bit's cool with the breaks and stuff. But then let's switch it up and we'll just put these pianos in. So we just all started putting the pianos in and you'd notice the difference straight away. Everyone would start putting their hands in the air. And then the more we're noticing people put their hands in the air, we're thinking, well, we'll keep more of this piano going. And then we notice that when you got the four to the floor moment, everyone's starting to sort of to bounce more instead of just sort of like chugging side to side. And it just was a natural thing. We just started speeding up a bit. The kick drums come a bit harder. We started losing the bass lines. And yeah, and really Happy Hardcore was born between, I suppose, Slipknot, Billy Bunter, Seduction, Psy, Ramos and Supreme were hugely important to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and sort of a couple of others. And we just sort of took that baton and off we went with it.
Were you sort of like, I don't know whether, was it a conscious decision? Because you almost sort of, you were still doing your own thing and were very hugely successful and many people's favourite DJ. But you also sort of had this collaboration going around that time with Vibes, where you guys had done Feel Free and a couple of tunes together and you were doing back to back. Was that a conscious decision or did it just sort of organically happen?
I've got to see Shane Vibes has got most probably the funniest personality I've still to this day ever met in my life. There is nobody who can make me laugh as quickly as that guy. And when we first met, I just felt like I was on a constant comedy show, like watching him. And he just said to me, Tom, Paul, you know, actually Shane was, because again, he was a bit older than me. He was sort of a lot to sort of do with me sort of getting a bit of a business head on. Sort of to start saving money and start making music. It was a lot to do with Shane. I did forget to say that. And he said to me, come on, come down to the roller skating rink in London. And, you know, we'll put our roller skates on and then there's a studio out the back and we'll do a tune and it'll be an all night session. And I'm still proper, really sensible kid at this point. You're like, what are we gonna, I'm going to stay up all night in the studio. He's like, yeah, it'd be amazing. We'll knock two tunes out. We end up at this roller skating rink and I met this guy called Grant Nelson, who's obviously a huge producer now. And we knock out Can You Feel Real Free in, I think, 3.5 hours, do a bit of roller skating at 4 a.m. and then do the other side where we sampled Shades of Rhythm and Here's Another Chance. And that's where you Can You Feel Real Free. And then we started working together, and because we both had the same like long blonde hair, we almost looked like brothers. And we just got on so well. So it was just, he was just so much fun. Ridiculous.
I can imagine. It's kind of weird because in the early days when I was a raver, Vibes used to sort of, see, some people won't associate this with Vibes, but in the early days where it was sort of just coming about, he would actually play some moody sets, wouldn't he? Like he would have some bassline-y, rollery, almost borderline drum and bass jungle sets in those days. And I remember going to raves with my little disposable camera because nobody had mobile phones in those days, trying to get a picture with Vibes. You couldn't get close to him. I mean, he was really sort of famous, wasn't he, in those days?
Oh yeah, he was brilliant, and yeah, sort of his wacky dress sense as well. You know, he's always in his like, what is he like? These like little waist jackets with a white vest, and you know, these sort of his blue jeans and stuff. And he was always brilliant with so he's like Paul, you got to wear this aftershave. The ladies love this aftershave, and I'm like, what? He goes, trust me, you'd walk down the street with him, he'd go. Gelga, who's wearing Versace blue jeans? Jesus Christ, he's not wrong. we'd be doing these back-to-back sets and we'd like go to the services after and he goes, Paul, come with me. And he'd go in and he'd reach for the top shelf and he'd get a copy of Over 50s Plus, he'd go and buy some rubber gloves, a tub of Vaseline, a cucumber and a banana and put them on the side and try and bite with a straight face. Like, what are you doing, Shane? Did he just do things like that for a joke?
he's an absolute superstar, isn't he? And he's, you know, professionally, he's always been really nice to me, like even in the early days when I started sort of doing the odd set with him, because obviously he had Lively as his MC for the most part, but occasionally I'd end up on his sets and he was always sort of really nice to me. And I actually got booked on his, I want to say it was either his 30th or his 40th. I think it was probably his 40th. So on his 40th birthday, we did a set together at the O2 and, again, I had a little bit of an out-of-body experience thinking, wow, imagine that. Do you know what I mean? Because he is a proper legend, you know? And but I do remember his sort of dark, moody era that he did just before Happy Hardcore. I mean, music's so wonderful. It's synonymous for hardcore ravers, techno ravers, drum and bassers love it. I mean, you know, he really, he knew how to work a dance floor. There's no denying.
Yeah, that track was sweet spot. That was most probably where it was sort of, it was so cool, but it was catchy still. Yeah, that, you know, obviously the vocal was such a great hook.
Yeah.
It was a real, really great period just there. Yeah,
absolutely. So talk to me about Essential Platinum. How did that start? Obviously you mentioned Mickey earlier. We talked a little bit about Vibesy. How did Essential Platinum get born? Where did that sort of first, you know, start to bloom and flower?
Well, this was when I was playing in Aldershot a lot. Was it called Rhythm State? Yeah, Rhythm Station,
yeah, man.
Wasn't it?
Legend.
Great club. So I'd be playing down there, and then I met this really skinny lad with black curly hair called Hixie.
Yeah.
And he, again, I, you know what? The things that bring me to people is always personality. Honestly, the talent side of it is very rarely what hooks me up with people. It's personality. And when I find someone who makes me feel alive, makes me feel good, puts a smile on my face, I want to be around them people. And Hixie was only just starting to really DJ then. He wasn't sort of doing that much, but he was such a lovely guy, so much fun. And he was doing a few bits, sending me tunes and that. And I was like, Ian, let's do a record label together. Look, you take care of the South Coast and I'll take care of the Midlands. Like, whatever you make, you keep, and whatever I make, but we could just build this label. And we were just trying to think of words, and I don't know, it's just somehow we landed on Essential Platinum. And then Ian was very good at sort of straight away. I can still see it to this day. He's very good at branding,
yeah.
Something I just didn't really think about. And he found this picture of this woman sort of with her arm in the air, like this statue, sort of all metallic-y and stuff. And we sort of used that as one of the parts of the logo and go. And then a guy from my school called Sander, he knocked up a little logo for me. Essential Platinum with a little piece of vinyl, and you know, we sort of put them together, and yeah, we just started doing releases together, and that was it. And the label just went bang. And again, I think we done one reward awards for that.
Yeah, well, it was certainly probably one of the kings of the castle, absolutely, along with Impact and a few others. It was Slipmat's label was Universal, I believe, wasn't it? And there was was definitely one of the titans. I mean, as a DJ, I'd always look out for that. I'd be absolutely gassed if I got a promo or a white label somehow of anything Essential Platinum, because you just knew it was a banger. And equally, from a geeky point of view, I remember the first release that I ever got with you guys on Essential Platinum was a big moment for me, man. It was phenomenal.
Amazing. So yeah, it was an incredible time, just to think we were doing so much so young. But big shout out to Shane for pointing me in that direction. I think it was, but Shane definitely switched me on to a lot of stuff.
Okay, so moving forward ever so slightly now, obviously you discover, I mean, the evidence is out there, everyone can go and find this, it's not a surprise, but you go on to discover this boy wonder, his name turns out to be Gamma, and you guys form this amazing partnership together. Talk to me about those early days of Dougal and Gamma.
Yes, so it was amazing how this happened. Right, so I was working with a guy in the studio and he kept saying to me, will you listen to my Ironing Lady's Son demo? And I was like, yeah, give me a CD, I'll have a listen to it. And me being me, it took me about 6 months to get him around to it. He pushed me a few more times to listen to it. And I listened to this sort of track that that Matt had done, and I was like, right, there's something there. There's not a lot, but there's something there. And I was listening to it thinking, how did he do this little flick? And it was just this very, very basic track idea. And the guy I was doing the studio stuff with, he was a musician. And I was like, do you know how he did this? And he's like, no. So I was like, right, I'm going to go and see this Matt. Right, let's go and see what is, you know, how he's doing this, these little trickeries. So I turn up at his house, and I'll never forget, his mum lets me in, and I go upstairs, I knock on the door, and I just hear a little, yeah, a real miserable, yeah. I open the door, and Matt's sitting there, curtains drawn, room is black, you know, it's dark as anything. I was like, all right, Matt, I'm Paul, you know, I've been asked to listen to your demo, and, you know, there's a couple of little bits in there I was quite impressed by. Can you show me how you did it? And all he had was his computer sat there and his tiny little speakers. And then he just literally went, got his little pen mouse and went, bum, 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 press play. And it went, this mad sort of weird riff. And I was like, do that again, Matt. And he showed me again. And then I was like, so if I played you something like else, can you replicate that? And I think I've just played him a couple of little other things. And without even listening, he started penciling these little blocks in, and then pressing play, and it was like these perfect arpeggios that mathematically were just unbelievable. And I could see straight away that he had something I've not seen before. And yeah. I was like, Matt, you know, I think maybe you should start coming to my studio and hanging out with me. I said, do you want to do that? And he was like, yeah, I'd love to. So my studio was the other side of town. Near enough, every morning, I think, from that day, he used to come in the studio with me. And the guy who I was working with at the time, he sort of lost interest, and he had his kids to deal with and God knows what. So he sort of fell by the wayside. And I just kept working with Matt every day. At that time, I'd do most of the engineering. I'd take care of all the mixing down and everything. But I noticed very quickly what would take me on the computer side of things, something, you know, like 20 minutes to do, Matt could do it in like literally 20 seconds. And I saw Matt's talent grow at such a rate. I've never seen anything like it. It was unbelievable. So then I like become good friends with Matt. And I was like, look, I'm going to get you some decks, because Matt at that time, he didn't have any money. So I went out and bought him a set of decks and a mixer. And they weren't 1210s, unfortunately, at that time. They were sort of like belt drive things. But took him to him for Christmas. Oh, my God. Within 2 weeks, he'd outgrown them and learned how to mix. So then he'd come back to mine where I've got the 1210s, and I'd be teaching him like my basic scratching, teaching him basic mixing. And I just taught him everything I knew. But within 6 months, his knowledge just was flew past at such a rate. But it was great because he had like the computer knowledge that I could never do. And he actually had musical knowledge. But what I suppose I brought to the table is what I still to this day, I understand what rocks a dance floor.
Yeah.
I understand hooks. And you put that knowledge with my knowledge, and it just worked so incredibly, the yin and yang of it. And eventually it came to the point to put Matt's first record out. And I was like, what do you want to be called then, Matt? And he's like, DJ Gamer. I was like, okay, Gamer, no problem. You want to be Gamer? Right, okay then. So put the record off to be pressed and everything. It comes back, and I told you, I'm dyslexic. It comes back,
yeah,
Gamma.
Yeah.
So DJ Gamma was born out of my spelling mistake.
And thank goodness for that as well, because Gamer would not have been a good DJ name.
It would not have flown quite as well. So, yeah, it's the one thing I'll thank my dyslexia for. So, yeah, and we just worked together, and still, I've never seen a talent like that in my life. Like, what he can do is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree.
He's half computer, half mixer.
It's amazing the way he picks things up. I mean, you know, obviously I've done numerous songs with him over the years and worked with him, you know, not quite as long as you, but perhaps nearly as long. And he is just a phenomenally talented artist, and everything he puts his mind to, he excels in. And I mean, I suppose the key question for me here, Paul, is, did you see, I mean, I know the skills are very different. I know the journey. I know as human beings, you're very different, but he was young. He was a teenager when you started working. Did you sort of see a bit of yourself in early Gamma? Or Gamer?
To be honest with you, he was, I think Matt would mind me saying, he was a bit of an outsider, and I was always an outsider. But what I saw in him was just raw talent, to a degree that was just undeniable. I would show off to people about, you've got to meet Matt. And so, and I used to put him on the spot sometimes, go, Matt, right, so show him, they'd say, like, name a piano line, and they'd go, oh yeah, well, Robert Miles' Children. And he'd just go, not even with no sound turned up, and he would just draw it in, bum, 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 bum,
yeah,
bang. He's not even listened to it.
Yeah.
And the line's there. And they'd just be like, there's a guy had come in the studio called Ashley Ingram, and he wrote a song called Desiree. Desiree's hit, So You Gotta Be.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
he was in a band called Imagination in the 70s. I mean, he is like, worked with Quincy Jones. I mean, he's like a serious guy.
Just dropping the Desiree. I mean, she was huge in the 90s, wasn't she? So yeah.
And he wrote that hit. So that's how big this musician guy was, this Ashley Ingram. And I showed him Matt, and he was like, never seen anything like it. I was like, right, if he's never seen anything like it,
yeah,
it says it all, really. And yeah, I mean, Matt was still walking to school when I met him, and then he was working, I think, at Little Chef and stuff. And then we just kept at it and at it and at it. And then one day we got it.
It's absolutely phenomenal. Listen, Paul, there's so many things that I could talk to you about. And with your permission, I'd like to get you back on for a second interview at some point in the not too distant future, if you're up for it, because I feel like we've been talking for loosely about an hour now, and I've got a million more questions, if I'm honest with you. So if you'd be happy, I'd love to do a DJ Dougal part two on the Pod Noodle, if you're up for it.
No problem. I think that's the perfect place to take off again, because the Matt and the Dougal and Gamma era is, I'd say, is where it literally, the life changes again, the new spectrum.
Well, absolutely, man. I mean, I could talk to you, because I mean, we did so many exciting shows for Essential Platinum. Obviously, there was you two at the helm. There was me. There was Jenna. You did a massive song with Smiley. There's so many things that we could go on to talk about. Just from this section alone. But for right now, for the viewers that are avidly listening to what is one of the most inspiring stories that we've had so far, I think, let's talk about what happens tomorrow. We've talked about the beginnings. We've touched upon Happy Hardcore, Essential Platinum, Hixie, Gamma. What about tomorrow? Like, where does DJ Dougal go next? What does the future hold? I mean, obviously no one can tell it, but I'd love to hear some of your plans.
Well, amazingly, it's almost full circle. Me and Gamma are working together again on a regular basis. What's so exciting. And we've done this song called Pow together, and it was our sort of second attempt at sort of doing something. It's just come out so good. I feel like we found a sound. It's not hard style. It's not old hardcore. It's just a combination of power, energy, hooks, craziness. It's everything that me and Matt have been doing for the last 20 years, coming down and reworking it and putting it together. Because sort of music, it went off on a bit of a tangent. The hardcore was all sounding a bit too hard style-y. Yeah. There was another sound that was all a bit deep and moody. So yeah, we're back. I think we've done 4 or 5 songs together now over the past couple of months, and they've just come out so good, being picked up straight away. And me and Matt, we're going to start a new concept together. So so it's going to be a little Dougal and Gamma Presents, name to be revealed soon. and we're going to start touring again together. For very special events, it must probably be 5 or 6 a year. But was obviously we're going to have all this music at our disposal in our own sets as well. But it's really exciting. I just love being in the studio with Matt. There's nowhere that makes me happier, apart from being in the studio with Stylesy and yourself.
Ah, oh, bless you. Thank you. Well, do you know what? If we were on the radio, I feel like there should be explosions and stuff. What can I do? Hold on. Hold on. Here we go. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Dougal and Gamma are back. There we go.
There you go.
Yeah. That feels better now, doesn't it? That's honestly so exciting, and I'm really excited. Also, and we don't have to talk about this very much if you don't want to, but you've had some commercial success, haven't you, recently as well, away from hardcore?
Yeah, I mean, so the weird things happen to me, and the one thing I would say from anything I've learned in life is just be open to everything and go into every situation with positivity, because you never know what could happen. And someone I know, I moved to London. I'd only met him a few times, and he was got friendly with him. And he was just out of the blue. He's like, "Paul, could you teach my friend to DJ? He wants to get into a bit of DJing." So I was like, yeah, no problem. So I got a controller, went round to this guy's flat, started showing him a few bits and bobs and stuff. And again, I was like, God, this guy's got a bit of talent. And he said to me, do you want to come to the studio I work at and do a tune? I was like, yeah. I said, I'll tell you what, you look after, you know, you hold on to my controller and you keep practicing, and I'll meet you at the studio. So I go to the studio, I walk in, and I'm like, bloody hell, Ollie, this studio is incredible. I said, you know, whose is it? And he went, well, it's mine. And I was like, what do you mean it's mine? And he's like, yeah, I wrote Peter Andre, Mysterious Girl, when I was 15 years old.
What?
And invested the money into the studio. And then he wrote Leftfield's album, Leftism. He's done Prodigy, Saturday's only number one. But then we started like having a little jam and stuff. And eventually we come up with this track called Human. And John Summit took it off us. And it's altogether, I think it's done about 100 million streams over all the platforms now. So,
wow.
And I work with Ollie a lot as well. And he's a genius. And again, I spotted it in him, but it's just being open to everything, you know, just, you never know what's around the corner.
No, you're dead right, man. Wow. Do you know, I recently, I can't say I'm friends with him or anything, we didn't exchange numbers, but I recently met Peter Andre at a show. How cool's that?
So
so
Wally from
shout out to Peter Andre, Mysterious Girl. Yeah, man. Right, okay, so we've come to the point of the podcast where I'm mindful, as usual, we've ran over. And there's certain questions that I ask every single guest. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you all of these questions next time you come on. So this will be your one time of doing these questions, right? So okay. I want you to imagine the scenario, and it's one that I'm sure you can relate to. You're driving through the night. You've done your first show. Perhaps you're on your way to your second or third show of the evening. It's the middle of the night. The motorway's a ghost town. And you pull over to get some petrol. And while you're in the petrol station, you're a little bit peckish because obviously you're a bit bored. You need something to keep you going. And in front of you is the multicoloured array of sweets and confectionery. There's chocolate, sweets, mints, there's all sorts of crisps. What are you reaching for? What are you going to go for?
Well, I go straight for the Huel drink.
Oh, okay. So you're a Bartlett guy, are you?
I look at that and I go for the Huel. I'm really conscious with my what I eat. I am super, super. I really have always looked after myself, and I do everything I can to avoid sweets, chocolate.
Okay, fair enough. Did you know, I fell down a TikTok rabbit hole of watching stuff about Huel, and he's also the Stephen Bartlett guy's also got another product where you can put like vegetable powder into a drink and all that stuff. And I reckon at least twice a session, twice of me entering the app, I see Stephen Huel sat there with his mic going, "Just try it.
Yeah.
Just try it." I must see that twice a day, every day. And I think I can imagine on my deathbed, it'll pop up on a screen somewhere going, "Just try it."
Yeah, okay. Still, yeah, it's just, yeah. And let me know what you think in the comments below.
Yeah. But,
I got into it quite a while ago, but yeah, I've just always been trying to go for the healthy option because let's be honest, my dad's had like serious heart disease.
Yeah.
He's had a stroke. He's got diabetes. So because it's in the family, I tried to bypass it. But if I had to, and you're going to twist my arm on it would be a double decker.
Double decker, man. One of the greatest. Oh, well, that's good. I can sleep easier now. Well, I think it kind of ruins the next part of my question, which is, if all of the takeaway restaurants were shut and only fast food ones were open, which one would you choose? But I'm thinking, based on that answer, you wouldn't choose any of them. You'd probably starve, right?
I mean, occasionally, I still have a sneaky McDonald's, you know, just try to...
Ah, Macca's.
Just try to keep it... Yeah, if I'm really sort of starving and haven't done it for a while, but just say, on the whole, I tried to keep on the good side of food, but, you know, trying to hold on to
trying
to look as good as Stalsy at my age.
fair play. Well, you're a beautiful man, DJ Dougal, and you always have
been.
Thank
you very much.
Right, okay, so for my last bit, and then I will let you go and get on with your day, is this section here. So I'm just going to quickly play you this.
Oh, yes, this is highly recommended.
So basically what we do here is I'm going to ask you a series of things that I would like you to recommend to our listeners. And actually, based on the feedback, people are really enjoying the recommendations. So my first one would be, and it doesn't have to be new. It could have been something from your childhood. What film do you recommend? What film does DJ Dougal recommend that the listeners watch?
Oh God. I mean, I'm still like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and it's strangely, do you remember the melody in that?
Yes, I do.
Again, these little hooks are why the simple melodies still go into my mind. That moment when they go play the five tones.
Yeah, that was an amazing movie. It still fascinates me now, even despite, you know, being 20, 30 years old. Great shout. What about TV? Do you watch much TV? Is there any series that you sort of binge or anything like that? Or are you not really a TV guy?
Yeah, I'm sort of, you know, love like Netflix and stuff like The Next Man. But yeah, I think, what have I just watched? Ripley was just recently on Netflix, pretty sort of dark and sort of mysterious. I found that pretty interesting.
Amazing. I don't know much about that, but I'm definitely going to go and do some research. At the moment, I've been watching, what's it called? Baby Reindeer. Have you seen that advertised on Netflix?
Yes, just finished that. That's definitely a journey of itself.
I'm going to mention this right now because I know a lot of our listeners have been probably watching it as well, but I don't want to ruin anything for those that haven't. But can I just ask you a question? Do you think the guy in it, the main character in it, do you think he's a bit bonkers?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I got from it. I thought it's just like a tale of a stalker, but actually the main guy's a bit bonkers. But anyway, absolutely. I don't want to ruin that for anybody. Go watch it. It's a good one. What about books? Do you read at all? Do you not have any time for that? Some people don't.
Again, I'll be totally honest. I've never read a book in my life, not because I'm not interested. I'm so interested, but my ADHD just runs amok and I end up reading five pages. So I listen to Audible all the time. I'm a much better listener, a reader. My mind, unfortunately, just skips.
That's fair. Lots of people are like that.
The one that stands out to me is Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself by Joe Dispenza. Actually changed my life without a doubt. And most of these things don't actually have an impact on me to that degree, but that absolutely is incredible. It just absolutely teaches you that, you know, if you being moody, being happy to a degree, it really is a choice. And if you're going to sit there in a mood, only bad things are going to happen to you. You have to find that positive mind state. And it really allows when there's bad things. My life might look perfect on paper, but believe me, I've had my ups and downs like the best of us.
Of course.
And that is absolutely incredible. So yeah, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, Joe Dispenza.
Final one. And this, as a DJ, you're probably going to struggle with. All of my guests have struggled. An album. Now, first of all, I want you to talk about an album that isn't rave music or dance music. Is there an album that resonates? As an example, BK suggested that one of Queen's albums was one of the non-rave albums that, you know, sparks memories and he enjoys. Do you have a non-rave or dance music album that you enjoy or used to enjoy?
I remember, I mean, I suppose it is slightly dance, but it was Delight's album. Do you remember Delight, who did Groove in the Heart?
Yes, I've got it on vinyl, actually. Yes, I absolutely
do. That album had some strange music on it. Really interesting stuff. There's a track on it called What Is Love?
So, okay. I'm going to be looking that up. Yeah, brilliant. Well, that's a really way out suggestion. So everyone's going to be jumping on their Spotify after this, no doubt, looking for it. And what about a dance album? Would it be the Simon Harris one that you mentioned earlier in the podcast, or is there a different sort of dancey, ravey album that you could suggest?
The one that stands out, it would have been, I think it's like a House Sounds of Chicago, and it was just all them Chicago house tracks in the very beginning. Or Electro 9, that was the first album I ever bought with Dougie Fresh.
Oh, Dougie Fresh and the Get Fresh crew.
True, yeah.
Six minutes.
Fresh, you're on.
Absolutely. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was DJ Dougal's.
Oh, yes, this is highly recommended.
Paul, thank you so, so much for your time today. Listening to you is timeless. Like, I could ask and listen to your stories and the way that you describe them. I'm confident that the people listening to this are going to absolutely love it. I just want to say thank you on behalf of all the listeners and, of course, myself for taking the time out to talk to us here on the Pod Noodle.
Thank you ever so much. And that's a big shout and many thanks to everyone who's supported me over the years, because, you know, without my fans and friends, you know, you're nobody. So thank you very much.
Ah, that's amazing. Actually, on Hixie's interview, I made people, and Hixie's rang me a couple of times laughing about it, but I made the listeners go to whatever his most recent post was and do the chef kiss emoji on Instagram. So, because DJ Dougal is one of the absolute kings of hardcore music, what I urge the listeners to do, if you've got to this point in the podcast and you've avidly listened to everything that Dougal has said, I want you to go to DJ Dougal's most recent post on Instagram, and I want you to put the crown emoji on it. And then when Dougal sees the crown coming from your account, he will know that you have just listened to his interview, and it's a great way of showing him support. So go to DJ Dougal's Instagram, find whatever his most recent post is, and put the crown emoji in the comments, please.
Thank you very much, WizKid. I look forward to round two.
Yeah, brilliant. Have a lovely day, my friend. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed what you heard here today, then please like, comment, and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments, suggestions, or anything else, ping us an email on thepodnoodle@wzkd.co.uk.